Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to rightly seat us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
There's a very interesting story interview in The Atlantic titled Whatever Happened to the Gospel of Jesus' Wife? A conversation with Ariel Sabar about the stranger-than-fiction story of a Harvard professor, a con artist, a papyrus fragment that made front-page news. What did happen to this story of this fragment where Jesus mentions his wife? Well, it turns out it was a forgery. No one was really surprised at that. But why do people have an infatuation with the notion that Jesus had a girlfriend or a wife or a mistress, something along those lines? Joining us to get an update on the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, Dr. Craig Evans. He's Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's author of numerous books, including Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back, Todd.
This story will ultimately turn out to be one of forgery. How common is forgery in the business and the study of manuscripts of the New Testament, the Old Testament?
Well, you know, they're actually common. I think it'd be fair to say that. Forgeries were going on of a biblical nature long before the time of Jesus and the early church. People, we call them pseudepigrapha today, claiming to be people like Moses or Abraham or even Adam, who had revelations of one sort or another or left behind a testament for their heirs, making predictions about things to come. It's a well-established genre, but in more recent times, this is probably what your question is about, in the last few hundred years, there have been plenty of forgeries of one sort or another, claiming to be writings from either a well-known church father or an apostle or a New Testament writer. You know, there's something floating around that's supposedly another chapter for the book of Acts, a long-lost letter of Paul, or yet another gospel. And so that kind of thing has been happening a long time, and it continues right on into the 20th century and beyond, and like Dead Sea Scroll fragments that came to light just 15, 16 years ago, and it turns out probably all of them, although written on ancient leather, all of them are modern creations. So it is, unfortunately, let's put it this way, it's not rare.
So what is this so-called Gospel of Jesus' Wife? Refresh our memory.
Yeah, it's a Coptic fragment. If you were to take your thumb and forefinger, both hands, and then join them together, that's about the size of it. It's a few inches long, a couple inches high. It would represent a chunk of a one page of papyrus. It's written in Coptic. Coptic is the Egyptian language using Greek letters. In it, it's just this fragment, and Jesus is talking with his disciples, and the whole question of women coming up and whether they're worthy of being disciples and so on. And then Jesus just throws out a sentence. He goes, well, my wife, the sentence breaks off. The conversation continues on the next line. And so you are to infer from this that here we are, Jesus is talking with his disciples, and doggone it, if he doesn't refer to his wife, who's probably Mary, And so this fits in then with the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, where Mary in both texts are referred to as a lead disciple. There's even a reference to Jesus loving her, perhaps even kissing her, where we don't know because there's a hole in the text. And this, of course, is what's behind Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. The book came out in 03, the movie came out starring Tom Hanks in 06. And so this forgery likely was inspired by that movie and the book.
How are they actually produced? Do we know?
Well, in this case, the forgery, he gets like an A, a grade of A for his materials. It's an honest-to-goodness, authentic piece of old papyrus. He doesn't know, of course, how old it was. Turns out it wasn't quite old enough, but he didn't know. It was an honest-to-goodness piece of papyrus from antiquity. He used the right kind of ink that's not subject to carbon-14 dating, because it is carbon. That's all it is. It's the greasy stuff that collects inside a smokestack or inside of a oven or something like that. That's one way ink was made in antiquity. So he did the right thing. He got the right materials. And so it has a general plausibility when you look at it, especially if you don't know papyri very well, you don't know ancient stuff, you haven't seen much of it. If you can't read Coptic very well, you look at it and you think, you know, that could be authentic. So it has a plausibility of it. Now, I don't give him an A for the grammar, the content of it, the overall execution of it, because none of these fragmentary sentences can be connected. So there's no continuity in the conversation. There are grammatical mistakes. He doesn't get the form right. And the more you look at it, the more you realize he's just cribbed from another text. He just borrowed words and plugged them in, and he didn't do a very good job. There's more we can say about it, but it gives it away as a modern fic.
So I take it that professionals like yourself are immediately skeptical of any claims to authenticity of any papyri that are found, much less ones that claim that Jesus had a wife.
Well, of course, the chances of a fragment of an otherwise long-lost text containing a few lines of a very provocative conversation where you have the proverbial smoking gun, where Jesus says, "My wife," and these are actually on the lips of Jesus. So it's not somebody talking who perhaps doesn't know what he's talking about, who says, "Well, Jesus has a wife." This is Jesus talking, and he says, "My wife." So what are the odds? This is an otherwise unknown text. And of course, immediately red flags go up. One of them is, well, if there actually was a text where Jesus identifies Mary or any other woman as his wife, why weren't church fathers in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries and so on talking about it? Whether from an Orthodox point of view, a heretical point of view, any point of view, that would be big news. Why aren't people talking about that? And that's always come up, the allegations. And, you know, in fictional writings and so on, there's always been the idea, like, what if Jesus was married? What if he really had a relationship with a woman? What if he actually had children? I mean, that kind of idea, that's all part of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that Michael Bajan and his colleagues produced almost 40 years ago. So that idea has been out and about. But the problem with it always was that would be a big deal in antiquity. How come nobody talks about it? Nobody ever says anything. Critics of Christianity, Christians themselves, intelligent people, learned people, nobody ever says one word about Jesus having a wife. And so out of the blue, here comes a text that's found written in Coptic on a piece of papyrus, just a small fragment, and Jesus says, "My wife." And so right away, it's like, oh gosh, what are the chances of something like that surviving from antiquity, and antiquity knew nothing about it? So right away, that's suspicious. But Todd, I have looked at hundreds of sheets of papyrus. I've held papyrus in my hands. I've looked at countless hundreds of high-resolution color photographs of papyri of New Testament writings, Coptic writings, other kinds of writings from antiquity. And my first look at this, when I heard this announced about 8 years ago, when I heard it announced, and immediately it was posted, this very good quality picture, And I looked at it, and, you know, instantly I said, that's a fake. It's modern. The ink doesn't look right. The ink would be flaky. It would be dull. It would have an aged look. This looks glossy and very black. It just looks too modern. And then I found out many other papyrologists had the same impression. A brush had been used. A brush, by that point, brushes weren't used any longer, just a quill or a stylus. And, of course, people who know Coptic far better than I, they read it and said, this thing's got glitches and mistakes in it. A real Coptic scribe in antiquity wouldn't be making these kinds of mistakes. So it was one red flag after another.
One of the concerns that many raised at the time was the provenance of this particular fragment. Why is it so important that you know where a thing came from?
Well, yeah, it's hugely important. And others have been embarrassed by either stolen things or fakes in recent years also. And I'll tell you what it is. It's two things. Provenance helps you, just reassures you that the item in question is legitimate. It's a real antiquity. It's been properly excavated, or it was part of a find, and there's like a paper trail. It's a chain of evidence. And so you know who owned it and when it was found and how it's been preserved and cared for and so on. The second thing is, of course, it guards you against the possibility of purchasing and publishing something that's been stolen. And so provenance is really important. And unfortunately for the scholar who published this fragment that she decided to call the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, the paperwork that she was shown was, with any kind of research and checking, would have shown her that it was fake. There were problems with dates and other pieces of information. It just didn't add up. And, of course, this whole problem has come to light in a few other well-publicized cases in recent years involving either stolen or looted artifacts or Dead Sea Scroll fragments that are simply fake. They were produced only in the last 20 years or so.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're getting an update on the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. We will turn to this Atlantic article, Whatever Happened to the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, and what it tells us about this story next. Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation. The entire cost is approximately $350,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
If you're visiting Frankenmuth, Michigan, come to Emmanuel Lutheran Church in nearby Frankentrost. A hardy band of German missionaries founded Emmanuel Frankentrost in the wilderness near Saginaw. At Emmanuel, you can still hear the law and gospel in a beautiful liturgical service, just like those first settlers. For directions and divine service times, visit frankentrost.org. That's FrankenTrost.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Come and experience firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the Word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to help them to get a sense of, A, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, well, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission@ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting an update on the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, author of numerous books, including Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels. So, Dr. Evans, what do we learn from this Atlantic story, an interview with Ariel Sabar, about how this forgery gets spun up into a Jesus had a wife scenario?
You know, I was in on this from the very beginning. Ariel Sabar, who has now written a book called Veritas, and it's quite witty when you think about it, because Veritas, which is Latin meaning truth, is an important part of Harvard University's motto. And the professor in question is on the faculty at Harvard, and it's an embarrassment for Harvard. They were very nice to me, I want to hasten to say, and this I know this scholar personally. I've avoided mentioning her name. I respect her. She was deceived, and I feel bad for her. And Harvard was very kind and gave me an excellent image that I can use in my book that's coming out in a month and a half or so called Jesus and the Manuscripts. And I do have a chapter talking about this. What Ariel Sabar did that scholars often don't do, because it's not our training. We're not trained to be detectives. We're not trained to be lawyers. We're not trained to be copyright attorneys and experts that way, and that's not what we do. We look at a text, we try to figure it out, exegete it. We do understand the importance of scientific testing, like carbon-14, that kind of thing. But we're not really trained in the forensics of tracing the chain of ownership. And so she neglected that. She looked at the paperwork. It seemed reasonable. There were some German names. It sort of, it sounded plausible. It matched with other cases that are genuine, where you have some alumnus for some Oxford college who comes back from Egypt and he's purchased in the antiquities market some pieces of papyrus. He donates them to his school. By the way, I'm talking about a person at Magdalen College, Oxford. That's P64, the oldest fragments we have of the Gospel of Matthew. And that's exactly what he did. And so the paperwork had that feel. It's like, well, this is plausible. And so she didn't pursue it. Well, Ariel Sabar, who wrote an article in The Atlantic, and of course now there are these follow-up articles too, talking about his work, the first thing he did as an investigative reporter, and I'd worked with Ariel before on other cases, and I know he's good. And so he phoned me up, and we chatted, and we've emailed, and so on. We've stayed in touch. And he said, well, he asked me, what do you think, Professor Evans? And, of course, my reaction was typical. It was, well, the ink looked brand new. The words looked crowded, fitted. It's like the fragment existed first, and then they fitted the words onto the fragment. Oh, I see. And he said, well, what do you think of the paperwork for provenance? And I said, oh, I've hardly paid any attention to it. So in a way, I was just like the Harvard professor. And so he said, well, that's what I want to track down. And that's what this story is about that's been reported. I think it's excellent. I'm glad the public can read it so they can understand where this went wrong. And it's good that we scholars look at that and think about it. Because, people, like I said, I'm not mentioning any names or institutions, but others have been burned in recent years by purchasing what turns out either to be stolen or faked. And so he decided to follow that rabbit trail, the provenance. Where did this come from? And immediately there was stonewalling. He asked the professor, well, who is the person who gave this to you? And she said, well, he has to be anonymous, and I'm going to respect that. Well, of course, that's what fakers do. So he wasn't satisfied with that, and he just had to do a lot of homework, a lot of legwork. It led him to a guy who at that time was living in Florida, and it connected one thing connected to another, including the fact that he had studied at Berlin, Coptic, the very place where this kind of papyri material could be found and easily stolen. And he kept doing his homework, and then he finally found out this thing is indeed a fraud. He actually visited the suspected forger's shop and saw similar pieces on display and for sale. So the whole thing began to unravel, and the Harvard professor and the rest of the community just, you know, that wasn't our cup of tea. We didn't pay any attention to that. And that's where Sabar, I think, gets an A+ for his work. He traced back the paperwork, and it was clear that this thing is a fake.
You have alluded to this several times, but there was a similar scandal. I think it's safe to call it a scandal with respect to some fragments. I believe not New Testament fragments, but maybe Dead Sea Scrolls. Yes, and the Museum of the Bible recently.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
It turned out that there's a lot of money in this kind of forgery, too.
Yeah, I know. I feel terrible. They're great people, and I endorse the museum, and I think the world of the Green family. They're good people. And they weren't served real well by somebody on their staff initially who was acquiring artifacts, mostly genuine artifacts, but just not carefully. And questions of provenance wasn't always well thought out. But unfortunately, they got victimized by the fake Dead Sea Scrolls. But then, truly no fault of their own, they were victimized by a professor of papyrology at Oxford who went rogue. And maybe that's what you're alluding to. And
yes,
actually stole New Testament papyri and other Greek papyri and sold them not only to the Green family and Museum of the Bible. By the way, Museum of the Bible has been totally honest and cooperated with authorities. They have returned the papyri in question. They've agreed to cooperate fully and make available all documentation that they have. And not everybody does that. This is my opinion, Todd. You don't need to endorse it, but the left-wing media isn't always very fair. And I think the Museum of the Bible has shown themselves to be good people, because there are other museums, like the Metropolitan Museum in New York, they don't always play so nice. And if it turns out they've received something that was looted or stolen a long time ago, they're not real quick to offer to return them. But the Museum of the Bible people have been really good, and if something is wrong and the authorities point something out, they cooperate. If it means giving back things, they do so. And I can hardly blame them on this question of some of the papyri that they purchase that relates to the Bible, because this guy went rogue at Oxford. I'm not going to mention his name. I know him personally. I have been in the Sackler manuscript library, the Bodleian Library at Oxford. I have held these papyri, authentic ones, not any of them ones that were stolen, but I've held them in my hands. And he betrayed his trust. And it's just like this chap who stole the papyrus and created the Coptic Gospel of Jesus' Wife. It's the same kind of thing. It's authentic papyri, that there's no question of that, which comes from Oxford. But it was taken, and a fictional story was created about it being recovered. It fooled me. We were all repeating that this old fragment of Mark was recovered from a mummy mask or some kind of papier-mâché cartonnage. No, that was just a cover story. And it was the same-o. It's a way, the provenance just didn't work. It was just a way of mysteriously coming into one's possession with some papyri. Oh, and it happens to be very valuable, and I'm acting as the agent for the guy who really owns it, and he wants to be anonymous, and that's how this works. And I think with these scandals now coming to light, I think a whole lot of people are going to be a lot more cautious in the future.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're getting an update on the Gospel of Jesus' Wife when we come back. Ariel Sabar, in the Atlantic article, makes some observations about postmodern scholars, even in this textual and papyrus study. We'll see what he's talking about next.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Timeless truth that prepares scholars to serve their neighbor in all of life through their various vocations. This is what scholars receive at Wittenberg Academy. If you are looking for a solidly Lutheran online education for your child, consider Wittenberg Academy, where doctrine is sound, academics are rigorous, and relationships are genuine. We offer full-time, part-time, and diploma track options to meet your child's Lutheran education needs. We partner with brick and mortar schools and homeschools. You can find out more at wittenbergacademy.org.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our study of St. Matthew with The Temptations of Christ. Jesus begins his ministry. Jesus calls the disciples. Jesus ministers to great crowds and Beatitudes Part 1. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute, verse-by-verse, Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
We're talking with Dr. Craig Evans, Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University, about the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, an update based upon an interview that appeared in The Atlantic with Ariel Sabar about this subject. In that vein, Dr. Evans, I'm fascinated by something that Sabar says almost in passing in this interview. He talks about postmodern scholars. He says they don't believe in the objective existence of facts as most people think of them. They believe that the people or the groups that have the power tell the story and essentially create reality. What is Sabar talking about?
I know exactly what he's talking about. Yes, this caper involving the Coptic fragment is related. He's talking about a much bigger picture. It's something that's been going on for decades. Todd, it's related to some of the idiocy that we see in our country today, you know, where people say what's really going on is facts don't matter. The revisionist approach to U.S. history, the vilification of the American founders, vilification even of people like Abraham Lincoln and U.S. Grant, Frederick Douglass, for crying out loud. And I know that's exactly what he's talking about, because in his investigations, he talked to a lot of professors, and he was very astute. He picked up on that. He's an investigative reporter, so by definition, he wants to know the facts. And Ariel was able to sense that, man, there are people, facts don't matter. Facts don't really exist. You create them, and it's through power. And so politics override objectivity and facts. You create your history. It's the side that wins. It's the side that has the power, tells the story. And it's the most insidious thing. And you know, in my world, there are some circles, academic circles, if you were to stand up and say, well, the facts lead us to conclude, you'd be laughed at. Facts, it's like facts are enemies. Either facts don't exist at all, or they're not recoverable. I was giving a lecture, this is 20 years ago in Toronto, and I was arguing against a very bad interpretation of one of Jesus' parables. It's a very important parable. It's about the wicked vineyard tenants, and the reason this parable is so important is Jesus is talking about himself as the son of the vineyard owner who was killed. And so it has huge Christological significance. And there are postmodern interpreters who say, oh, no, no, it has nothing to do with that. It's something else. And so they undercut the Christology that's implied there. And so I marshaled the actual evidence, how this parable would have been understood, would have been told, how, in fact, the gospel writers have it right and do understand it correctly. And here are the facts. And during Q&A, one of the guys, I'm not going to imitate, he sounded so weird, I won't imitate that, but he raised an objection. And he said to me, Professor Evans, you're too preoccupied with facts. You need to use your imagination. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry, but my imagination isn't evidence. My imagination does not constitute facts. And I realized, boy, this is where we are now. This is Toronto, Canada. It was 20 years ago. That's what Ariel Sabar is talking about.
So you can't really do your job archaeologically with texts or any other artifacts if you give up on the idea of objective truth, can you?
Oh, no, yeah. Yeah, you're so right. You can't. What's the point? There's no motivation. We've talked about this before in the past about the mythicists who say there was no King David, and you know, and then along comes the House of David inscription that was found at Tel Dan, and the initial reaction was to, oh, that's fake. Somebody threw it in the ground. Then the very next year, they found another piece of it, and so it became impossible to say it was a fake. And then there was an attempt to say, well, it doesn't really say House of David. It means something else, and it was a ludicrous suggestion that was made. And step by step, you know, the archaeology just kept blowing apart these bad arguments. And you wonder, well, what is motivating them to keep coming up with these bad arguments? And this is why. It's this philosophy, I have a different story in mind. I have a new politics. I want to retell and revisit and revise history. And that's what we're seeing right now playing out in streets of American cities and violence. We don't care what the facts are. We have a new theory, a new narrative that we're going to advance. Facts are irrelevant. They don't matter. And people get snarky and surly if you insist on talking about facts. And, you know, and that's where we are. We're in a dangerous stage in Western civilization. And so this incident with the gospel of Jesus' wife is just a tiny little symptom of a larger malaise. And that's what Ariel Sabar, I was quite taken by that. I thought, wow, this is getting deep philosophically at this point, that particular topic came up. But that's exactly what he's talking about, how our academic elites are annoyed by the concept of facts or truth. And that's what's really ironic in the title of his book, Veritas, the Latin word that means truth. And you have to ask yourself, is there really any truth left, not just at Harvard, but our elite universities? There are people on their faculty who say there is no truth. And if there is, we can never find it. And that suggests we're drifting into a post-Christian world.
Why does there seem to be a perennial infatuation with the idea of giving Jesus a wife or a consort?
There are different reasons for it. Some of it is just a salacious interest in things like that. By the way, I think that's exactly what was motivating the faker, not just the chance to make some money. He is himself a merchant of porn and erotica. I think it reduces Christology. It goes back to the illustration I gave a moment ago, about 20 years ago, talking about that parable. If Jesus has a girlfriend or a wife or a lover and he's produced a child or two, then how's he really different from anybody else? How in the world is he actually the Son of God? How is he somebody who's divine, whose death on the cross amounts to anything? He's just another guy. And I do think there is that agenda at work. And so if we can turn Jesus into a guy like anybody else, he watches hockey, drinks beer, and has a girlfriend, he's just like anybody else.
Finally, then, someone is going to say, look, maybe a lot of this stuff is faked, or, you know, I see all this talk among scholars about a fragment of this or a fragment of that. Can we trust the reliability of the Bible that sits on our shelves and on our desks?
Well, I certainly think you can, but you are right in raising the question. It's pushed the burden of proof onto the shoulders of those who think there actually is truth and authenticity. Again, that, you know, it's like a promo for my book, Jesus the Manuscript. That's exactly why I wrote this thing. It's a big book. It's 600 and some pages long, and I deal with the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter. I deal with the Gospel of Jesus' wife, Secret Mark, and all the rest of this stuff. But I also talk about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and those manuscripts and how old they are, how long they were in circulation, how stable the Greek text is, how history and archaeology, in fact, lend them very important support for their authenticity, their factualness, their historicity, and so on. But you're right, in raising that question, it shifts the burden. We can't just say, look, this is the inspired word of God, you should trust it. You have to trot out evidence, and there we go again. We're into evidence and facts, and that's what I deal with, and it's comparative. I want people to see that, wait a minute, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are very credible. They're very ancient. They're close to the original sources, the eyewitnesses, and so on. They exhibit verisimilitude. They reflect the way things really were then, and archaeology supports that. And these other writings that are come along later, they don't. They contain all kinds of mistakes. They don't reflect the early first century Jewish world. But you have to show it. You have to trot out the evidence and make the case. That's what I'm trying to do. And so what these forgeries do when they get exposed, they actually help us make the case by contrast. And we can compare them and contrast them with much better sources, and hopefully people can see the difference.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's author of numerous books, including Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels, and the forthcoming Jesus, the Manuscripts. You'll find a link to these resources and to Dr. Evans' website at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's This Week in Pop Christianity. We'll discuss Francis Chan's claim that Christians are like Jesus, both God and man, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Listen and vote in advance at facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel. More than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.